Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to Open Minds UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am here. Wait for it. This is really exciting. I have with me Jason McClellan.
Wah, wah.
What's with the wah, wah?
Well, it's not that exciting. You really hyped it up for people.
That's extremely exciting, I think.
Well, I think you're the only one who thinks that, but thank you, Alejandro.
No, there's all kinds of women out there who are like, oh my God, it's Jason.
That goes without saying.
So, today we have a great show. We have David Marler, who I always become big fans of, well, not always, but sometimes when I like the guest, I become a big fan of theirs after I talk to him, and this is one of those guys. David Marler's awesome. He wrote a book recently called Triangular UFOs. He's been in this field for quite some time, worked with MUFON for many years, out in, I think, in the Illinois area mostly, and but now he's in Albuquerque. But he's done a great thing. I don't know that anybody has really compiled all the information on triangular UFOs like this guy has and put it all together in one book. I know NIDS did Bigelow's group, the National Institute of Discovery Sciences did an investigation, but that was one paper, and that was great. But Marler's included that and more information over the decades, actually going back like 100 years on UFO sightings, and what he's found is extremely interesting. He's done a great job, so we're going to talk to him about all of that in a little bit. And then just before that, however, we've got in touch, or a TV show got in touch with us, because they want to do a TV show on people who have had experiences with UFOs. And so we're going to talk to one of the casting guys from that TV show in just a minute here. But before that, the moment you've all been waiting for is UFO news, because you want to hear what Jason has to say about the best UFO story of the week.
Well, why is mine going to be the best? Why isn't yours going to be the best?
It probably will,
yeah.
But I just wanted to kind of, you know, throw you a bone there.
Okay, well,
mine's
going to
be,
it.
But I have no doubt, mine's going to be way better.
Okay, well, that's why you let me go first. All right. Well, Alejandro, as we talk about time and time again, it seems that the UK has a lot of UFO activity, and that certainly seems to be the case right now. There have been tons and tons of reports coming out of the UK and England in particular about UFO sightings and some interesting UFO photos. The one I want to talk about, the incident occurred on Friday, October 4th, and this is a green UFO, and the green UFO was seen by multiple witnesses on that night. One witness took his photo, saw the object around 9 p.m. at night, took a picture of it, and he described it. He posted it to his Twitter account and described it as a green circle in the sky, and he says it was just floating. Another motorist nearby was driving and saw it, saw this green UFO and stopped, and he took a picture of it too, and he described it as a ring of light in the sky. He said it was either a blue or green ball, and it just sat above the tree line. So he pulled over and watched it and couldn't believe it. He said it wasn't hovering like a helicopter. It was really strange. He doesn't believe in UFOs. And, again, that's something that I've been reading in a lot of these sightings recently coming out of England. People seeing them aren't UFO believers per se. You know, they're looking for other explanations, but from what they describe and what they saw with their own eyes, they have no explanation for these sightings. And this green one is interesting because, from what I can gather from the photo, it's not a solid sphere or ball of light in the sky. It's actually a circle. You know, it kind of looks like a glow stick that you wrap around your wrist. You know, it's it actually has a hole in the middle. It's just this circle of neon green light.
Yeah, pretty strange. And that it made a lot of headlines, this one.
Yeah, because there were photos and it was seen by multiple people, and it just looks so darn strange.
And it's funny because it's just so interesting, I think, how much Twitter is like a mode of communication. Because here's another one that was kind of a Twitter phenomena that happened here, and it's gone big. And it seems like so much in conventional news as well, like the people are referencing Twitter when it comes to quotes or pictures or anything.
Well, it is. You know, you and I have talked about this before. I mean, it's really the best tool for breaking news and the easiest way to post it. And, you know, because a lot of changes that have been made to Facebook and how posts are displayed and they're displayed selectively, I think you get to see more on Twitter. But, yeah, the media and everything, just the ability to embed the post with the comments. We do it on our site all the time. I love Twitter, and I think it's really becoming the norm for news. And Twitter's actually getting into it too, doing their own sort of news thing using their platform. So, yeah, it's great. And we've seen it used a lot more just in the last couple months too.
Yeah, I mean, a big explosion, even with politics, the biggest stories. And I just think it's funny because there's all this conversation about still not even completely understanding the tool. So as it goes public, for instance, how do we make money off of it? How do we understand what people are using it for and why, and then how we monetize it? All of these questions, yet they morph, and the social world online morphs and changes all the time, and it's just an interesting time for online communication.
Yeah, I think so, and I get excited by it. I mean, you and I use this every day. I mean, I'm a big fan of it, and Twitter especially. I was resistant years ago.
Me too.
When I first got into it, but yeah, it's definitely something that I love, and I understand why people use it.
So, and then speaking about lots of UFO news in the UK, we had two other stories that were pretty interesting from the UK last week as well. One from West Yorkshire, and then a guy who used his iPhone and a telescope to get a UFO. So, like you said, lots of UK news.
Yes, sir. So, are you going to do a UK story? Probably not.
No, I'm going to bring it back home. So. Probably the Pascagoula, because I think that's the biggest. And that was, of course, in Pascagoula, October 11th, 1973, a man named Charles Hickson and a younger man who was, I believe, 18 or 19, the reports say, Calvin Parker, and they essentially were fishing, and this UFO comes. They see these weird creatures come out with, like, this you know, no face and these spikes coming out of their heads and these clawed hands, and they were scaly. And essentially these guys hovered out of the craft, then took Hickson and Parker into the craft, examined them with this mechanical eye, and then let them go on the shore of the river they were fishing at. The cops come and get them, or they call the cops, and then the cops come and get them. Cops interview them, and they're skeptical at first. But the cops had put a recorder in the room with them when they left to get them. They're going to be like, haha, we're going to get them talking about how they faked it all. And that wasn't the case at all. These guys were freaked out and like, oh, my God, what had happened to us? You know, these cops better believe us because it's just incredible. And, you know, things like, oh, my God, you know, I hope we're going to be okay. So they were really freaking out. What's cool about this is that the AP was able to interview Calvin Parker, the guy who was younger, and he kind of went in hiding after this. You know, he didn't really do interviews. He stayed away from the limelight for like a year. He did a couple interviews in the 90s, but then he went back into hiding. And they were able to interview him for the first time at the 40th anniversary. And he talked about how he would change jobs if his job found out about him being part of this UFO event because it was a big deal when it happened. So it was interesting to see him for the first time doing some interviews. Now, Charles Hixon, he did a lot of interviews and went to UFO conferences and everything. He, kind of like Travis Walton is right now, he was out talking about it a lot. And however, he passed away just a couple years ago. So it was interesting that the AP did a story on it 40 years later. And they did talk to the cops, a couple of the cops that were there at the time. And they said, you know, at first we thought they were lying, but we did a couple polygraph tests that they passed. And they were like, you know, we tried to trick them and we didn't. And these guys really did exhibit real fear from something that had happened to them. So real interesting case, always fun to visit those.
And it's so great to see that, you know, this was an AP story. And because of that, this case is getting all sorts of renewed attention. And there's so many headlines about it today. So that's really cool to see. I mean, this is mainstream media and it's all over the place today.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, I think they started with the story on Friday and it's been blowing up. And I think a lot of, you know, a lot of the coverage is pretty good too. It's not totally making fun of this thing. It's because I think the information is compelling, especially when you have these police officers who try to trip them up and aren't able to.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, I mean, for most of the headlines and stories I've seen, yeah, they're pretty straightforward reporting. Not any of the jokey comments or anything. So that's
mm-hmm.
great to see.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. So that is the news. Remember, you can go to openminds.tv to read these stories online. Many of them have videos attached where you can watch them as well. And you can watch Spacing Out on our YouTube channel where Jason and Maureen cover all of the news from the past couple of weeks. So check that out. And that's probably a lot of fun, huh, Jason, doing Spacing Out? You like that?
What am I supposed to say?
Well, you're supposed to say if you like it or not. If it sucks, you could be like, no, it's lame, I don't like
no,
it.
No, now you put me in the position I have to say I like
Maureen's
it.
Maureen's always mean to me.
Well,
she pulls my hair.
Well, Maureen's now definitely mean, but we're not talking about Maureen and her meanness. But yes, Alejandro, Spacing Out is a blast. Maureen is fantastic, and you're very nice saying that we cover all of the news, and you know that's impossible. There's so much UFO news every week, so we cover as much as we can in the time period we have, but yes, a lot of fun doing that show, and I wish we could do so much more.
Yeah, well, you do a lot, so it's good stuff.
Thank you, kind.
We're going to talk to Mr. David Marler in a minute, but first, let's talk to Bobby, who wants to recruit some of you to be in his TV show. See what Bobby has to say. Okay, thank you so much for joining us, and maybe if you could share your name and who you're with to begin with.
My name is Bobby Platzer, and I am a casting producer, and I am working on a new major cable network show dealing with ufologists and alien enthusiasts, researchers, and also Bigfoot.
Okay, great, and so right now you're kind of in the hunt for people to be in the show?
Yes, we are currently casting right now nationwide. So we would be coming to the potential participants. So there are no geographical limits in the United States. And we are looking for people who, you know, are big-time UFOologists. That's one of the terms I've heard. But, you know, people who are really into aliens and the study of them and searching for them and talking about them and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm. And I think that someone was telling me you're kind of also looking for people who have had, mostly looking for people who have had experiences.
Yeah, we are. I mean, we're open to everybody, but okay. People who have had experiences are, you know, that's just so interesting. And so that's definitely something we are, you know, kind of focusing on.
Mm-hmm. And not just people, maybe people who have had experiences with possibly with UFOs, or some believe they've had experiences with aliens, or some believe they've had experiences with Bigfoot. So all of those?
All of those, okay. And more. And a lot of people have theories that Bigfoot is related to the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a lot of people in the UFO community and the Bigfoot community have told me. It's kind of contentious, but I'm open to hearing about it.
Yeah. And so the story is just to put people's
mind at ease, because I know a lot of people get a little nervous to participate in these programs because they feel maybe they're going to be made fun of.
Yeah, we're not out. Our program's a little different. We're going to hear the stories, and what we've found is that a lot of people have, you know, people in their lives who don't love that they do this and that they are made fun of. Sometimes we've heard of people who got divorced. We've heard of people who've lost friends. They got made fun of at work. And our show is kind of to share their stories and to open, you know, people's the dialogue between people who believe and people who don't believe, and find a kind of some resolution for them.
Okay, right. And if I remember, I was talking to someone who said one of the things you kind of like is people where it's caused a little bit of turmoil within the family, where perhaps that could be worked out. You all can help to work that out.
Yes. The goal is to, you know, bring those people together, the, you know, ufologist or the squatcher, the people who go hunting for Bigfoot, and somebody in their life, family, friends, coworkers, significant others, and who don't like it, and kind of bridge the gap, see what the problem is, and, you know, kind of open both sides' eyes to both sides' different viewpoints and kind of create that dialogue.
Okay, great. And so how would they go about getting a hold of you if they wanted to be involved?
To get a hold of us, you would email us at castingbigfoot@gmail.com. That's our email. It did start Bigfoot, but we've opened it up to, obviously, alien people who've had alien experiences. Or you could give me a call at 818-980-2732, extension 301.
Okay, great. Thanks. I think there'll be some people interested, and I think there'll be definitely people interested in getting some help in, you know, kind of bridging the gap, like you said, between family members or loved ones who just aren't interested in their interests. And people who have had experiences, of course, want to share that with loved ones. And who got the idea to do that?
Well, the company we're working with, they had done another show that was specifically about Bigfoot, and I think they realized that they were talking to people, and this came up a lot, you know, in their casting process and their filming process, that this was kind of a common thing, and it was something that a lot of them shared. It was one of the common threads besides, you know, obviously Bigfoot. So they decided, you know, it's like a – it's kind of misunderstood you know, hobby or pastime, and that there was a lot of this going on.
That is interesting because, you know, until I got involved with kind of seeing the paranormal researchers or getting to know them and stuff, I didn't realize how much of a issue it was where, like you had mentioned, spouses and things, really it becomes a major problem in their relationships.
Yeah, this could become a major problem, and it doesn't, I don't really get why. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really have to be. So we're looking to, you know, bridge those gaps and hopefully help some people and, you know, maybe change some minds.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us about it.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you, Bobby, for coming and talking about that. Remember, people, you can go to castingbigfoot@gmail.com and tell them if you want to be a part of it, or call 1-818-980-2732, extension 301, castingbigfoot@gmail.com. So that sounds pretty interesting. That'd be a lot of fun if some of you were involved with that. And maybe you can get some family issues resolved. That would be really nice, huh? But without further ado, let's talk to my new buddy, David Marler. I'm very excited to have on the phone with me David Marler, MUFON investigator and also an author. You've got your new book. This is really exciting, on triangular UFOs.
Yes. It's been a labor of love.
Well, and what's really cool about this, and there's a, you know, note on it on Amazon talking about the book, is that a lot of people write about triangular UFOs. It's a big topic, but I don't know anybody else who's devoted a whole book just to the topic.
Well, and that was actually the rationale behind writing the book, Alejandro, was in talking with various researchers like yourself. You know, many books, as you mentioned, touch on the subject. You have magazine articles, certainly the internet, you know, you have ubiquitous reports of triangular UFOs, but no one has really devoted, as you mentioned, a book dedicated very specifically, and I say those words very carefully because I was very specific to focus solely on this subset of UFO reports. And, you know, certainly I'm no stranger to the subject. I've actually been researching triangular UFOs specifically for about 13 years now. But just within the last year or two, I actually developed it into a book form. And so far, it's doing quite well.
Mm-hmm. What's I've always found interesting, too, is you have a lot of – because working with MUFON, you know, working with people like John Schussler, who worked at NASA, or mm-hmm. John Alexander, who you have mentioned in your book, does a preface, and Bigelow, who a lot of people think are skeptical of because they're very conservative and nuts and bolts in their research. But all of these people are truly mystified by the triangular UFOs, and even NIDS had done an examination where they felt that this wasn't government secret projects, that it's something different. So just to demonstrate the fascination that even the most hard-nosed investigator has had with these sightings.
Absolutely. I find them to be particularly interesting. Of course, you know, not to slight the UFO phenomenon in general, I think, as I'm sure I can speak for you, the entire subject is absolutely fascinating. I think it is the most fascinating subject. But given the prevalence of these triangular UFOs and giving the high quality reports by extremely credible witnesses, as you know, military in many cases, I thought that it deserved much better attention and a much more detailed analysis than had previously been done.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, we'll get into more details in the triangles because there's a lot to talk about there. But I did also want to talk about you and get into your background and how you got interested in the topic of UFOs.
Well, being the author of my first UFO book, you know, I assume that most people, you know, aren't that familiar with me, at least, you know, those that haven't been involved in UFO research in the Midwest and so forth. But I thought what would be good is in the book, I actually address that very issue. I try to introduce myself and explain how I got interested in the subject. I think it's important for readers to understand the author as well as the author's material. And my interest actually began way back in 1973 at the ripe young age of 5 years old. And a famous UFO wave that was occurring in 1973, of course, as you know, 1973 was a pivotal year as far as UFO activity across the United States. But specifically in southeast Missouri, there was a wave of UFOs being seen in and around the area of Piedmont, Missouri. And subsequent years later, a professor, Dr. Harley Rutledge, who was the physics professor at Southeast Missouri State University, actually wrote a book, which is now a collector's item because it's so rare, called Project Identification. And what really launched my interest was the fact that my father was born and raised just outside of Piedmont, Missouri. So we had extended family that lived down there, and either they or neighbors and friends of theirs had observed firsthand these UFOs. And so what was interesting was the fact that I was living in the St. Louis area at the time with my family, and the St. Louis media had gravitated towards this subject. There were numerous newspaper articles, television reporters flocking down to Piedmont, Missouri, and trying to capitalize on the story, which, of course, for the investigators at the time was probably a thorn in the side because, you know, quite often, as we know, the media sometimes get in the way of us trying to conduct a serious investigation as UFO investigators. But since I was only 5 years old, unfortunately, I was relegated to stay home with my mother while my older sister and older brothers hopped in the car with my father with thermoses of coffee and binoculars. And they were flocking down to Piedmont, Missouri to, you know, quote unquote, look for UFOs. And much of the St. Louis area community was doing the same. So it really became a hotbed of interest on the UFO subject at the time. But I'll never forget, you know, being impressionable, being 5 years old, the excitement, the activity surrounding that. And then more importantly, them coming back and talking about people that had seen things. You know, they had conversed with a lot of the witnesses while they were down there. So I was hearing all of these stories. And over time, you know, that was really kind of the catalyst, if you will. And then that was in 1973. 1977, my sister and brother-in-law had a very close encounter, and I don't use that term lightly. It was like right out of the scene of the movie Close Encounters, where they were outside of Kansas City, Missouri, driving home late one night around midnight, and literally the car was bathed in a spotlight, There was no wind disturbance. There was no noise, but there was something above the vehicle that had bathed the entire car and surrounding area in this beam of light. Terrified my sister's husband tremendously. He didn't like to talk about UFOs, ghosts, or anything paranormal to begin with. But over the years, they would talk about that sighting that they had. And then 1 year later, just northwest of St. Louis, Missouri, in a small area called Ellsbury, Missouri, they had a wave of UFO sightings and, more importantly, cattle mutilations that were occurring at the time. And like Piedmont, the St. Louis media gravitated towards that. So it was very pervasive. It was front page news. It was in, you know, the top news story for local media at the time. So, you know, again, you know, at the age of 10 years old now, I'm hearing about things going on in Ellsbury. And beyond that, my father was always interested in the paranormal, specifically UFOs, although never actively investigated the subject. So I kind of grew up hearing about these stories, and, you know, my father always encouraged me to maintain an open mind towards things. Don't believe, but don't necessarily disbelieve. So in 1990, though, much later, I became actively involved in UFO research when I was a member of MUFON.
Mm-hmm. So, have you had a sighting yourself?
I have not. I have spent countless hours in Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, and other areas doing nighttime vigils where they had UFO sightings literally the night before or the weekend before, where they had cattle mutilations occur a week earlier. But I have not seen anything that I couldn't readily explain as aircraft, satellite, et cetera. So mm-hmm. I have yet to actually be, I guess you can say, a quote-unquote an experiencer myself.
Well, hopefully it'll happen. And I think that's an interesting question, because it seems like the majority of people, because I like to ask, really get compelled to get into this field, especially the real skeptical when they do have a sighting. But there are many, like myself, and I just asked this question of John Greenwald, and he was the same, where, haven't had sightings. I have now, but for the longest time as a researcher, I didn't have sightings. So it is more of an intellectual mystery, you know, that's compelling us.
It is. And I just, I consider myself a pretty pragmatic individual. And, I've worked in the medical field for 15 years and in related, areas. And so I'm used to dealing with facts. I'm used to dealing with hard data. And I'm not used to just chasing shadows or fairy tales. I consider myself very well grounded. And but at the core of this very anomalous phenomenon, I think that there is a reality behind it. What that is, I have yet to find that out, as I think all of us do. That's why we call it a mystery. But it certainly does not in any way inhibit me from continuing to try to pursue this subject, because, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's the most fascinating subject out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. And so you must have found triangulars, I think, because the book is Triangular UFOs. You must have found triangles particularly interesting, because you were compelled to do the book.
Yeah, and actually it's interesting. You know, sometimes it all comes down to, I think, timing with certain incidents. When I joined MUFON in 1990, I'm now an independent UFO investigator, but when I joined MUFON in 1990, as you may recall, around that time period, one of the hottest subjects within UFO circles was the famous Belgian wave of triangular UFO sightings that started roughly October, November of 1989 and really continued on until early spring of 1991. And so I think it was partly due to that my interest was really piqued, because at that point I was really absorbing everything I could get in the way of UFO information. You know, I was, a relative newcomer to the subject as far as I mentioned, actively, you know, being involved in investigations and research and really, you know, digesting the material that was out there, the, 40, 50 years plus worth of data that was in books and journals, et cetera. But I was really captivated not only by the quality of the reports coming out of Belgium, but namely the credibility of the people that were reporting it. As if, of course, we have military pilots, we have ground personnel. We had at the time Colonel Wilfried de Brouwer that was giving press conferences. And quite to the contrary of what the United States Air Force would do, they were coming out and acknowledging it point blank, that, yes, there's a phenomenon here. We don't understand what it is. And they were releasing the radar tapes from the F-16 jet intercept that took place in 1990. And so it was really just a kind of a breath of fresh air to have such openness on the part of a country, and more specifically a country's Air Force, in discussing the subject. So I was really intrigued. And not only that, but it's one thing to talk about a 30-foot diameter disc that's flitting around in the sky. You know, as most people that are listening to this are well aware, these triangular UFOs are not small. You know, conservative estimates place them around 100 to 200 feet in length. And again, that's conservative estimates. I have estimates that are much larger than that. So these are significant sightings in every way, shape, and form.
Mm-hmm. What I found tremendous, too, about that case is, I mean, I knew about the case. I knew it was awesome. But it got particularly close to it. And I'm not sure if you were there in San Jose in 2008, the MUFON Symposium, where Wilfred DeBrower came to speak. And he had this amazing PowerPoint and goes over the case. And it was incredible to see how many resources and how serious they took this incident, or these incidents, because it happened over years.
Absolutely.
And how serious he still takes all of this.
Yeah, that's a good point to bring up, that even in retirement now, I mean, he still does talk publicly about it. And I think that obviously this case really resonated with him on a personal level. Of course, you know, being over here in the United States, you know, we're hearing about all this secondhand. But mm-hmm. in his situation, I mean, General DeBrower, you know, knew a lot of these individuals within military circles personally, you know, talked to the pilots, talked to the ground personnel. So, you know, he was intimately involved with these individuals from a military standpoint. And so I think more than anyone, he could speak to the credibility of the individuals associated with those events.
Mm-hmm. I always like to mention that, because when people, especially skeptical people, ask about, well, you know, what should I look at? I always point them to go buy the DVD, because luckily MUFON has it on their site of General Wilfred DeBrower on 2008 talking about this, because it's absolutely incredible what had happened there.
Absolutely.
It's interesting, too, that I recently wrote a story about Cosford and UFO incident, where Nick Pope had asked the Americans about triangular UFOs. And are you familiar with this story?
I am. They were getting, you know, not just with Cosford, as you know, but there were numerous reports being, reported in that general vicinity at the time of triangular UFOs. And rightly so, the most pragmatic way to approach it is, well, maybe it's something that the United States military has. So let's make some official inquiries.
Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, the Americans, according to Nick Pope, said, they're not ours. We were wondering if they're yours.
And I believe the Belgian military did the exact same thing, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's a big mystery. Now, when you approached it, did you have an open mind, or did you kind of have an idea of, well, hypothesis, like you thought these are probably military or not?
Well, again, I really tried to take a logical approach to the subject. And what really, as I mentioned, the Belgian wave captivated my initial interest in triangular UFOs. But then 10 years later, January 5th, 2000, we had the famous triangular UFO sighting over southern Illinois, which I personally investigated. And I was Illinois state director at the time for MUFON. And that really solidified my interest. I mean, like I said, Belgium piqued my interest, but now I was directly involved in interviewing the witnesses firsthand, and essentially this object was seen roughly 15 miles from where I lived at the time. So I was very familiar with the area, very familiar with the various municipalities where many of these police officers worked and resided. And so now all of a sudden I'm interviewing these police officers, and as I'm literally sitting in the police station interviewing them, I'm making notations, and as they're describing this large triangular UFO, in my mind, I'm going back to statements made by the gendarmes 10 years earlier in Belgium. And point for point, they were spot on. I mean, there were so many correlations between the Southern Illinois UFO incident and what occurred in Belgium 10 years earlier. And so really, that's what really launched my research, because my attitude was this: if there are so many similarities between these two cases, are there similarities with other cases in the 50 plus years worth of data that we're now sitting on?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started doing an exhaustive historical analysis of cases, newspaper archives, military files, et cetera, and came away with the fact that contrary to, you know, popular opinion at the time, and even now, if you go on the internet, you'll see many postings that allude to this, that these triangles are something new in the field of ufology. You know, these are new, so they must be military. Well, based on my 13 years of research on this particular subset of reports, I have cases going back to the late 1800s, going back to the early 20th century, 1930s, 1940s. And what's interesting, Alejandro, is they don't only match in the simple description of a geometric shape. They match in the way that these objects fly, the flight characteristics, the lighting characteristics. I essentially identify 20 common denominators associated with these cases that, regardless if you're looking at a case from 1930, 1940, or 2013, they bear striking similarities to one another. And my argument is these things have been reported worldwide because I have numerous reports from all around the world that I've documented, and they're all essentially describing the same thing. So as a logical individual, I have to ask myself, is this something that the United States military has or has had going back to the late 1800s, or are we dealing with something else? And based on my exhaustive analysis, you know, I very hesitantly have to state that it seems like it's the latter, that we're dealing with someone else's technology.
Mm-hmm. And some of these similarities, what are the similarities that span from the late 1800s to today's cases?
Well, you know, one of the characteristics is the ability for, well, let's first just go beyond the triangular shape, large size objects. In fact, there's reports going back to the early 20th century describing these UFOs. And in fact, there was one going back to the late 1800s that was, believe it or not, documented in Don Quixote's first book that he describes. Mm-hmm. And he goes on to describe sightings in the Dutch East Indies, describing these objects being 200 feet in length, dark and triangular, and more importantly, multiple flights. In other words, not just a solitary UFO being seen, but multiple flights of large triangular objects that were seen over the Dutch East Indies in the late 1880s. And what's interesting is not only the size, but the fact, as I mentioned, that they're often seen in groups of two or more. And that's another characteristic that bears out time and time again. There's multiple reports of these objects either flying in pairs or in multiple groupings of triangular UFOs. There's a case in the Air Force Project Blue Book files I talk about in the book from 1949 in Baltimore, Maryland. And they describe seeing multiple triangular UFOs. And there was an artist that actually sketched a diagram of what he and others had witnessed at the time. And the Air Force investigators had stated that, you know, based on, you know, the credibility of this individual and the fact that all the other people on that city block all basically were describing the same thing, they came away feeling that these people had actually seen something real. But that's just one other example. The other unusual characteristic is the fact that when these things turn, and this is certainly characteristic of the January 5th, 2000 incident, as well as Belgium. But again, looking across various countries over decades, these objects, when they turn, they don't bank like a conventional aircraft. They literally make flat turns where they just pivot on their axis and then go into a different direction and then will move away. In conjunction with that, absence of sound in most cases, although under secondary characteristics, there are some reports when they're at close proximity to the witness where they do discern certain noises. And I do talk about those cases, but the vast majority, these objects are described as low altitude and making no sound whatsoever. Matter of fact, one of the police officers I interviewed from Lebanon, Illinois, who unfortunately now is deceased, his name was Officer Ed Barton. He was a self-described military brat. He said, I grew up on multiple Air Force bases. And he told me point blank sitting in the police station, he goes, Dave, he goes, every aircraft that I've ever seen, you know, military, commercial, makes some type of noise. He goes, I was out, we actually went out in a squad car where he observed the UFO, and I knew the area, you know, having lived in that general vicinity for many years. it's extremely rural. You could literally hear a pin drop if the wind is not blowing. That's how quiet it is out in this area. It's just a small county road. And he stated, he goes, this object was directly above me about 500 feet, and there was no noise. And he said, I can't speak to the R&D aircraft that might exist out there, but he said, every aircraft that I've ever seen makes some type of noise. This object made no noise.
Wow. So I'm wondering about also then the outliers. So, for instance, it seems like the sightings of triangular craft are pretty similar, but there are some outliers, some that are very mm-hmm. from the conventional.
Absolutely.
But what is the percentage? Is it like, you know, 90% of triangular UFO reports are similar, or 50%, or how much are these outliers, you know, do they exist?
I haven't done like an official statistical analysis,
right.
But I would say off the cuff that I would have to actually put, I would say, Alejandro, probably 95% of the reports on file are, like I said, point for point, essentially describing the same thing. Now, there are outliers, you know, certainly. As we all know, there's a vast array of objects that are reported that are labeled UFOs. One example that I actually mentioned in the book, you know, to state that, you know, we're not dealing with a homogeneous body of data. There are outliers, as you mentioned. But there is, in fact, one case, the famous Bentwaters UFO incident, where there was a very small object reported by Sergeant Jim Peniston, where he described a small triangular object that was hovering above the forest floor. That's kind of an, you know, I don't know if it necessarily fits into this category, other than the fact it is it was described as roughly triangular. But that's just one example of one of those that just doesn't seem to fit the mold.
Mm-hmm. See, I think that's significant, and I think that's what's really exciting about your book and your work here is that this is a significant subset of the UFO phenomenon, and an examination such as what you're doing is really important to find out some statistics like those you just mentioned.
Well, and actually, you know, talking about statistics, I was curious how prevalent these sightings were. And so as kind of part of my initial research back in 2004, I looked at the National UFO Reporting Center statistics based on reports based on shape of object reported. And what I was astonished to find, because I consider, you know, obviously it's hard to talk about frequency data because as we all acknowledge mm-hmm. that we probably only actually hear about one out of every 10 UFO sightings, you know, that are ever really formally reported. So I'm always a little leery when we talk about statistics because, you know, the amount of data we're receiving is sketchy at best relative to what is probably actually occurring. But I found it interesting looking at the National UFO Reporting Center statistics back in 2004. They had on file 2,782 triangular UFO reports at that time. And when you look at the classic disc that's reported, the classic disc came in at 2,439. So the triangle had surpassed the classic flying disc or flying saucer report, again, based on the National UFO Reporting Center statistics. And then later, I did a follow-up lecture at the late Lou Farish's Ozark UFO conference. And prior to that conference in 2012, I looked at the statistics from February 2012. And, of course, it's a cumulative total, so it encompasses the ones I just mentioned. But I wanted to see if the pattern still held true, if, in fact, triangles were kind of at the leading forefront of UFO reports. And in February 2012, the National UFO Reporting Center had 6,957 reports on file. Again, looking compared to the classic disc reports, there was only 5,288 of those. So I thought it was interesting, and I just mentioned it just to kind of underscore the fact that these are being reported, you know, with increased frequency. I'm not naive enough to assume that maybe in that mix we're not also having reports of, rightly so, you know, some type of military aircraft that might be triangular in shape. And I talk about that in the book as well. You know, certainly we have the stealth bomber, stealth fighter, and there's other aircraft out there that are purported to exist. But, you know, we hear about this TR-3B aircraft, but as I point out in the book, we have no factual evidence to support that aircraft exists. You know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, we heard about the Aurora aircraft. And not to say that it doesn't exist, but we still do not have any official acknowledgement that the Aurora aircraft exists, nor do we have any official acknowledgement that this TR-3B triangular aircraft exists. So, you know, I'm not naive enough to assume that some of these reports might not be military craft, but I think we're probably dealing with maybe a mix, that some people are seeing military aircraft in some cases. But again, when you look at the I think the historical argument is the strongest argument for the fact that these triangles apparently are someone else's technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you might have some extrasensory perception as well, because you just like in a row answered the next three questions I had. But we'll drill down into these a little bit more. So, for instance, you mentioned the stealth bomber, which was, you know, being developed, flying in the early 90s, but still top secret.
Mm-hmm.
From your research, do you see, of course, besides Belgium, which, well, we could go there first.
Sure.
I mean, do you think, and it has been proposed and people have thought about it, there's any way that the Belgium sightings were due to, for some reason, us testing a stealth bomber over Belgium?
You know, again, I would have to argue against that, one, you know, for a number of reasons. One, if we can assume that the inquiries were answered respectfully, the Belgian military had made inquiries, you know, with the United States Air Force to see if they were, in fact, flying anything in that in their airspace. And, of course, the answer was no. Now, obviously, you know, we can question the veracity of that statement. But we have to think of the implications of flying an experimental aircraft in foreign airspace without their permission. And I might add a fellow NATO ally. There are a lot of implications that go into that. And why would you do that? Because, as we know, they dispatched F-16 interceptors after these objects. You don't fly an experimental, and I would assume very expensive aircraft, in foreign airspace with opening and inviting the possibility that your NATO allies may accidentally shoot it down.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't understand the rationale behind that if it was, in fact, military. But I don't think that's the case. And beyond that, again, when you look at the descriptions, the flight characteristics and so forth, these are radically advanced aircraft. I'm not talking 10 or 20 years ahead of the curve. These objects defied physics as we know it in many instances, the way that they flew, the fact that they could accelerate and increase in altitude, decrease in altitude based on the F-16 radar tapes. These were exotic aircraft, and that's I'm using the term very loosely, because I mean these are extremely exotic aircraft. And again, when you look at the Belgian wave and you compare it to the historical analysis that I've done, these objects are what were being described decades earlier. And a point of interest, in my research, I found an article from Flying Saucer Review, and they interviewed and talked about a wave of triangular UFO reports sighted in the same general area of Belgium. There was a wave of sightings in 1972.
Wow.
And that was also investigated, ironically enough, by the UFO organization that was functioning at the time, known as SOBEPS.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1972, they had a wave of sightings. And more importantly, in my historical research going back, the Belgian military was certainly not the first one to have to deal with this situation. I actually found some very notable reports going back to 1957 and 1958, where there was actually a wave of similar aircraft or similar UFOs described over Denmark. And this was being actively investigated by the Danish Defense Intelligence Network. And I actually found newspaper articles to support this, the descriptions that were being reported at the time. And these witnesses were describing dark triangular objects that were hovering low altitude. And I even found an Associated Press news article and Reuters news article that described it. And the title of it was Spaceships Over Denmark was the title of it. And it goes on describing that triangular UFOs have now invaded Denmark. And they go on describing these objects as being 200 to 300 feet in length.
Right. Wow. And, you know, I think you bring up just a host of excellent points. It seems pretty silly that we'd be flying stealth over Belgium. Though, by the way, I'm looking at this figure. They cost in 1997 $740 million each.
Yeah.
So I don't think, like you said, you'd want that accidentally to get shot down.
No, and it's interesting too, Alejandro, because in my book I also talk about the Hudson Valley wave of sightings, and it was ironic that at the time they were interviewing both, obviously, UFO investigators, and a matter of fact, I think I quote an article by Antonio Huneas back then, who had done a really nice write-up of what was going on, the activity at the time. And what was interesting is, not only do I feel that way, the late skeptic Phil Klass, who I was in correspondence with, I was doing my January 5th investigation, even Phil Klass, when asked by one of the reporters, do you believe that these objects that are being seen in New York are some type of top secret military aircraft? He said, absolutely not. And he went on to state, and I quote him in the book, and I'm paraphrasing, but Phil basically stated that, you know, why would you fly a top secret experimental aircraft over an area where people are already prone to be looking up in the sky looking for UFOs? He goes, that makes no sense. And in fact, his position was bolstered by an Air Force officer that was also interviewed. And he stated, it makes no sense to have a top secret experimental aircraft and flying it over populated areas, which was an argument, ironically enough, I made in 2000 when asked about the January 5th, 2000 incident, because it was sighted so close to the proximity of Scott Air Force Base. Many people, including reporters in St. Louis, assumed, well, this must be something military. And I was willing to concede at the time. Of course, this was before I did my historical research that, well, that's the most practical explanation. As UFO investigators, our first explanation is not, you know, aliens from outer space. We're going to rule out all the prosaic explanations first. And then if we can do that effectively, then we're left with a genuine unknown. But it's just interesting that even the late skeptic Phil Klass, when asked about that, said it made no sense to fly a top secret experimental aircraft over a populated area.
Right. And speaking of which, you know, staying along this line, the Aurora, for example, it, although we do have better evidence, I think, that it exists, but like
yes.
You said, we can't be sure. But
nothing
even,
conclusive, yeah.
But even if it does, it has like an advanced propulsion system, but really doesn't seem to act any different than any other conventional plane, except for maybe it's faster.
No, exactly. And, you know, that's a good point you bring up, because if you read the articles, especially the late 80s, early 90s, when we were first kind of getting inklings about this project, and, you know, and then there's even ambiguity there. Was the Aurora a plane, or was Aurora kind of an umbrella title that encapsulated multiple aircraft? But the initial reports was that the Aurora project was a high altitude, high speed air reconnaissance aircraft, which when you compare that to reports of these triangular UFOs, most of the reports are describing these objects flying 500 to 1,000 feet altitude, moving slowly to the point where witnesses even stated you could walk with it and keep up with it. It was moving too slow to be an aircraft. And then, you know, the fact that these things were silent. We're not talking hypersonic, high altitude, you know, reconnaissance aircraft. So it doesn't even match, you know, the purported, reason for creating the Aurora aircraft. It just doesn't seem to match, you know, the description.
And then when it comes to the TR-3B, I mean, this is kind of controversial. A lot of listeners might be concerned with this sentiment. But, I mean, as time goes on and we don't hear anything more about this alleged craft, it seems to play that to the idea that it probably never existed.
What's interesting, I'm glad you bring this up, because it was kind of a bone of contention for me as I was writing the book, because I would be on the internet just kind of, you know, looking for information. I would see random postings by individuals, and it's one thing to reference the TR-3B. I have no problem with that, but it was the way that people were referencing it. It was assumed by the way they were talking about it that it existed. It's like, well, they probably just saw the TR-3B. It's just
right.
Like, okay, first off, we have no validation that this truly exists. It's a hypothetical, and it may exist. I'm not going to sit here and you know, try to prove a negative. I can't prove that it doesn't exist. But my argument is, for those that claim that it exists, provide some proof. And there have been individuals that have come forward that stated they work directly on the TR-3B. And I brought two, I thought very salient points up in my book. Two things. One, if they do have knowledge of working on this, then they need to provide some type of evidence to back up their story. Otherwise, I'm sorry, it's just a story. And second of all, this object has never been declassified, correct? Which implies that it is still a classified project. And if these individuals supposedly worked within defense, within the defense industry on this aircraft, then by the virtue of the fact that they're talking about it, they're in violation of secrecy oaths. So how come these people have not been arrested for violation of those oaths?
Right. So that's a tough one because and not only that, with the Aurora, you have a lot of more people in the industry, aerospace industry, talking about it. You have more eyewitness accounts.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot leading up to that. Whereas with the TR-3B, it's all very anecdotal, much like your worst UFO cases, where unfortunately, and I don't mean to, it's just, you know, as researchers, you and I look into this stuff. And
absolutely.
Unfortunately, the veracity of the evidence for the TR-3B is very shaky.
I agree. I mean, I share that same view, and I know we're probably in the minority when it comes to that, especially, like I said, if you look at the number of statements on the internet. And all I'm simply saying is, you know, come forward with the evidence. Now, people can say the same thing about me with regard to the triangular UFOs,
mm-hmm.
but a point of, I think, distinction needs to be made there. And that is, it's one or two people that have really come forward claiming to have firsthand direct knowledge of this military project. So all of this is stemming from one or two individuals that have come forward claiming insider information. What I'm talking about comes from hundreds of eyewitnesses worldwide spanning decades. So yes, is this anecdotal information? Absolutely. Is it hard evidence? Absolutely not. But I think that as a friend and former Missouri State Rep wrote on the back cover of the book, I'm basically trying to build a case. I'm simply, you know, putting forth the information and letting the reader really decide what they think of the material. But in my estimation, you can't ignore the eyewitness testimony from so many people that include military, you know, that include government officials, that include law enforcement officers. And, you know, talking about law enforcement, there's a number of law enforcement officers that are eyewitnesses to these objects that are documented in my book. January 5th, of course, Belgium with the gendarmes. My argument that I make in the book, as I'm sure you have made in the past and other researchers have made, certainly not an original idea on my part, but it's a valid point that I think we need to make as UFO investigators. These police officers, before the events, you know, that they've reported, UFO events, were deemed credible individuals. Obviously, they were able to maintain a position within law enforcement. You cannot just automatically, because they then reported a UFO, now deem these people not credible.
Mm-hmm.
They're either credible or they're not. And in the case of Belgium, in the case of Southern Illinois, and so many of these other cases, these people didn't lose their jobs after reporting this. So obviously the police departments, the communities still deem these individuals credible. So you can't pick and choose. You can't say, well, they're credible when it comes to, you know, interviewing a criminal eyewitness or interviewing an accident victim, but they're not credible when it comes to reporting UFOs. They're either credible or they're not. You can't cherry pick.
Right. You know, it's funny, too, and this is, I guess, what I really love about this, the triangular UFOs, and I think it's kind of ironic, is that, you know, as investigators, like you just mentioned, you're open to the idea maybe the TR-3B exists. I agree.
Absolutely.
It
absolutely
could completely exist.
I cannot rule it out as a possibility.
But it's funny because by doubting it, we're frustrating a lot of people. And at first, you know, the groups such as John Alexander or the Belgians,
sure,
or
sure,
Bigelow or John Schuchler, all of these hard-nosed researchers who are all out there saying the same thing. They're saying, you know, I don't think it is a TR-3B. I think it's something much more mysterious, which is something typically the UFO crowd wants to hear. But
exactly,
sometimes it's something they get frustrated about when it comes to this topic.
Well, no, I agree. And it just, if I may just make a quick point, you know, John Alexander did the foreword to my book. And a lot of people, I've been doing a lot of interviews and attending a lot of meetings. I'll be attending the conference in Chicago in a couple of weeks where I'll be discussing the subject. But, you know, I would like to just mention, because one of the questions that always comes up is, why or how did John Alexander come to write the foreword to your book? And, or, you know, why did you have him? Why did you approach him? And I actually turned the tables on people when they asked me that. I said, well, actually, I was speaking at a conference in 2012 at the Ozark UFO conference, and he approached me. We had never met prior to this conference, but he heard my presentation, and he came up immediately afterwards and complimented me on my research. And he goes, you know, that is a damn fine presentation, and actually wanted more information, if I would be willing to share more of my information, which, of course, you know, I make public. I've lectured on it for, you know, a number of years now. And so in the process of developing that kind of ongoing dialogue, since John had written a book on UFOs, since John is famous, or some may say infamous, within UFO circles, I just really just kind of out of the blue just threw out a question to him in an email and said, John, I'm seriously thinking about, you know, consolidating all my research into book form. And I know that you have a very special interest in these triangular UFO reports. If I was to do something like that, would you contemplate writing the foreword to the book? He emailed me back. He goes, matter of fact, he's like, Dave, I would be honored to. So it just kind of developed from there. And, you know, to your point, John doesn't believe every story that comes along, quite the contrary. But even in his own book, as you mentioned, he singled out triangular UFOs and stated there is a genuine mystery here that needs to be understood, you know, much better than what we understand now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talk to him on a regular basis, and I think his work is great personally, but I know he revels in his reputation of being infamous. So.
Oh, yes. Matter of fact, I'll be in Las Vegas in about 2 weeks, right before the Chicago conference. I'm hoping to meet with John while I'm in Las Vegas, so hope to catch up with him.
Yeah, great. Another question I want to ask then is, by looking at all of this data, of course, if you look at some of the work of some people who seem to be putting together some sort of motivation, like Robert Hastings' work with UFOs and nuclear weapons.
Yes.
It doesn't seem as though, and I could be wrong, and that's why I'm asking, that the triangular UFOs seem to be as involved with kind of these nuclear situations. But do you see, am I wrong, and do you see a pattern?
Well, I have to qualify. Based on the case material I have thus far, I haven't seen any interaction with ICBM, you know, missile silos, like what was documented by Robert Hastings in his book. But there, Larry Fawcett, you know, of course, the late veteran UFO researcher Larry Fawcett, he described a sighting. I believe it was Indian Point Nuclear Facility. And this was also discussed and documented in the book Night Siege, where a triangular UFO was seen over a nuclear facility, power facility. So there have been those instances. But to your point, relative to, say, other UFO reports, I haven't seen a strong correlation where they seem to be gravitating towards these sensitive military areas, other than the fact, as NIDS had pointed out and as we saw reflected in the January 5th case, they have been seen near military bases, but not necessarily sensitive military weapon storage areas.
Right. So are there patterns that you have seen then?
Not so much. Mm-hmm. As far as locales where they've been reported, the only characteristics I've really found have been with the UFOs themselves, both in the way they're described, the way they behave, the flight dynamics, et cetera. But I, you know, as it's ironic that in writing the book, my goal was really to get the information out there. What I wasn't really anticipating was the landslide of correspondence and material that I'm having directed to me.
Wow.
People that are hearing about the book, reading about the book, contacting me with information, contacting me with, you know, sketches, case reports, et cetera. And matter of fact, I haven't told anyone this, but just in the last 3 to 4 weeks, I was actually contacted by a group in Belgium that are former SOBEPS investigators that read my book and sent me some of their material. So we've kind of got an ongoing dialogue now. And even Professor August Meissen, who did the analysis of the radar data from 1990 when the F-16s were pursuing these objects, Professor August Meissen contacted me and had read the book and was very impressed. And so I've had a little bit of dialogue with him as well as some other European researchers. So I thought I had a lot of information to share with other people, but obviously there's people out there that have a lot of information to share with me as well. So what I'm hoping to do is consolidate all this. And over the next year, my next project is to develop a website, which I have to mention is in large part possible through the contributions of the Lou Farish Trust Fund, UFO Research Trust Fund. They gave me a research grant to not only share my UFO research in the area of triangular UFOs, but to also share historical UFO material, which I have a large library of. And when Lou Farish passed away, I actually took on his extensive UFO library and files. So my goal is to get that information out as well, not just with triangular UFOs, but with historical case material in general.
Wow, great. Well, and I was wondering where that went. Now I know.
If you need anything, or if there's anybody that has any questions or they're looking for case files or information, you know, I ask them to feel free to contact me.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's with all the research and all the best researchers kind of are similar. It's like the more you know, the more you find out how just enigmatic this phenomena is.
Well, the more I learn, I realize the less I know.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's some Shakespeare or someone said that is the mark of a wise man.
I always get, and that's one thing, you know, I think with my publisher, Richard Dolan, I was telling him, I said, I'm not arrogant enough to presume I have any answers, but I'd like to help think that maybe I've helped refine the question with this book.
Right. Well, what I think you've done is absolutely incredible and so extremely important, and it's gotten me real excited. And a lot of times, you know, I do these interviews and I fall in love with the researcher, and this is one of those cases. So this is super awesome. You definitely gained a new fan. But you're speaking soon.
I am. I'll be at the Heartland UFO Conference in Tinley Park, Illinois. And as a matter of fact, it'll be in 2 weeks. It's going to be October 25th, 26th, and 27th.
Okay, great. And I think people can just go to Google and put in Heartland UFO Conference and find it, right?
Yes, that, or if you type in Illinois MUFON, I believe it'll direct you to their website, and they have a link right there where you can actually go and find out more information about it.
All right, perfect. Well, thank you so much. They can go to Amazon to get your book, or probably go to Richard Dolan Keyhole Publishing to find it as well.
Yeah, richarddolanpress.com is his new website that he has, and you can get information there on the book as well as you mentioned, amazon.com. And I would encourage people, if they're interested, take a look at the book, and more importantly, reach out to me. I'm interested to get feedback from my readers, good, bad, or indifferent. And as I mentioned, I'm getting a lot of good information, so I hope to share that with everyone once the website gets up and running.
Perfect. Well, I'm definitely looking forward to that. Thank you so much for joining us, and this has been extremely interesting.
No, thank you, Alejandro. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, so thank you, everybody, for joining us again. Thanks, David. That was a really great interview. And remember, you can go to richarddolanpress.com. It's no longer Keyhole Publishing. He's called it Richard Dolan Press. So you'll be able to go there to get the book. You can also just go to Amazon and look for David Marler or for Triangular UFOs and find his book there as well. So again, you can visit openminds.tv for all of our latest stories. You can visit our YouTube for lots of cool stuff on UFO sightings and, of course, to watch Spacing Out. I also want to remind people of the International UFO Congress, which is going to be February 12th through the 16th of 2014. I haven't been talking much about this, but now we've got things ironed out for the most part. We got everything ready and rolling. Remember, go get your hotel room right now. Go book that as soon as this show is over, or even pick up your cell this very second, because the rooms go really quick, and that's at the Radisson Fort McDowell. If you haven't been to the conference and you want to call especially so you can come, because the place is gorgeous. The venue is just awesome. It's out in the desert. It's a lot of fun. We have a lot of incredible speakers. We have Timothy Good. George Norrie is going to be there. Aaron Sagers. He does a paranormal paparazzi on MTV. We've got NASA scientists, scientists galore. We've also got Stephen Bassett to talk about the citizen hearing. We've got James Gilliland talk about UFOs. We got crop circles. We got Bigfoot. We got abduction. We've got Jaime Musson, ladies and gentlemen. Always a crowd pleaser. So you definitely want to go to the Congress, and right now you can still get in on the early registration. So that's at ufocongress.com. Of course, we've got links to it also at openminds.tv. But it is time to register and come to the conference. You're going to love it. It's a lot of fun. Of course, you can meet Jason and Maureen and I, and that alone is worth thousands of dollars in a trip halfway around the world. But you don't have to go to halfway around the world. You just have to go to Phoenix. Although lots of you are from the UK and stuff, so you do have to go halfway around the world. But it's worth it because we're awesome. So come check us out at the Congress. It's going to be a lot of fun. UFOCongress.com. I'll tell you more about it, too, in the coming radio shows. And we'll have some people who are speakers coming on the show, too. So it's going to be a lot of fun. So check out the Congress. Also, I do want to thank the people who do the music for the show. Caleb Hanks, who does the opening music, and Two Earth Minutes, who does do the close. And I want to thank you all so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week, people.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.